Yud Aleph Shabbat, Thursday, 21st of January, Rabbi Chase Taub, Emotional Sobriety, Get Your Life Back by Letting Go.
Amazing.
How much time do I have?
Go away.
Until 9 o'clock.
Until 9 o'clock.
Big clock over there. It's a big clock.
Got it. Excellent. Ready to go? Okay. There's a story that's told about the Husyat Nerav. There was a Chassidus. They come from the Ruzhiner. Rabbi Yisrael Ruzhiner was a great grandson of the Mezritcher Magid. And, Goyer, thank you for a clock. They put a clock in front of me. There was once a Rav who gave a drasha that was a little bit long. And afterwards, one of the Balabatim said to him, you know, the Rav is not aware how long he spoke. And he said, well, there's a problem that there wasn't a clock in the room. And the Balabas said, yes, but there was a calendar. So, at any rate, the Husyat Nerav, that's a chassidus from they come from the Ruzhiner, and like Ruzhin, it's a town in Ukraine. But in the interwar period, in the 1930s, the Husyatner court moved from Eastern Europe, from Ukraine, to Vienna, Austria, and Central Europe. And if you know, today Wien is doch a chassidische Stadt, but in the old days, in the 30s especially, Vienna wasn't Hungary, it was Austria, you know, it's a cosmopolitan city, you know, coffee shops and Sigmund Freud and all that stuff. So to see a Hasidic Rebbe walking down the street was something of an anomaly. And there was a reporter for an Austrian paper, and he asked somebody, who is this gentleman? And they told him, this is the Husyatner Rav, and he's not just a regular rabbi, a regular rabbiner, he is a Wunder Rabbiner, a wonder rabbi. So the reporter said, well, I've never met a Wunder Rabbiner. Could you arrange a meeting? And they did so. So the reporter met with the Husyatner Rav, and he said to him, I hear that you are a Wunder Rabbiner, a wonder rabbi. Could you explain to me what that means? So the Husyatner Rav said as follows. Well, you know, there's a typical rabbi of a congregation, and he's in control of a shul. And then a little bit higher than that, you have a shtat rav, you know, the rabbi of the city, and he's in control of a whole town. And then you have above that, you have a chief rabbi, and he controls a whole country. And then you have a wunder rabbin, or a wonder rabbi, and he controls himself. So the topic today is about controlling the one thing that Hashem gave us the power to do anything about, and that is ourselves. Somebody once told me that there are three things I cannot change: the past, the truth, and you. I can't change you. I can change myself. It's the only person I can change, but I can't change you. And then he explained even further, which was particularly helpful for me. He said, anytime I find myself in distress, if I will stop and I will be honest with myself about the source of my distress, I will, without fail, catch myself in the midst of trying to change one of those three things. Either I'm in the middle of trying to change the past, or I'm in the middle of trying to change the truth, or I'm in the middle of trying to change you. And I will get no rest, I will know no serenity until I can accept those things as they are and put all of my effort and my focus back on myself. So I'll tell you a little bit about my story in a nutshell, is that my father is a psychologist. People ask me very often, am I a psychologist? Do I have any psychological training? I say, yeah, I have psychological training. I went to yeshiva, specifically a Hasidic yeshiva, especially a Chabad Hasidic yeshiva. So, you know, we learn about the way things are in the Eilam Asalyanim, and everything's B'Tzelem Elokim. The way the Nefesh works is a mirror image of the Sphirois. And so basically, yeah, I learned psychology. I learned Tanya, and that's my psychological training. But as a kid, I used to look into my father's books, psychology books. And my father's a psychologist, and I rebelled. I became a rabbi, so that was my form of rebellion. At any rate, I remember I was about 15 years old, and my father, the psychologist, says to me, "What's the difference between psychosis and neurosis?" And by the way, growing up in my home, I understood that that was the setup for a joke. So I responded properly, according to the formula of a setup for a joke. I understood I was playing the straight man. So I said, "I don't know, Dad. What is the difference between psychosis and neurosis?" So my father says, "Psychosis is when I think 2 plus 2 equals 5. Neurosis is when I know 2 plus 2 equals 4 and I can't stand it." What does this mean? Chazal tell us a very simple formula. What's 2 plus 2 equals 4? What are the facts, the immutable facts of reality? Chazal tell us, Hakel bi de shamayim chutz mi yiras shamayim. It's a Gemara in Brachas. It's a very categorical statement, doesn't leave a lot of gray area, black and white. Hakel bi de shamayim. Everything is in the hands of heaven. Everything's in the hands of heaven. Hashem is running the world. Chutz, except Meyiras Shemayim, where do you have power? Where do you exert control? Your Yiras Shemayim. What does Yiras Shemayim mean? How you feel? And I think it's interesting that Chazal specifically used the term Yira, because there are a lot of emotions. But in this particular case, what's being emphasized? That Hakul Bi Shemayim, everything's in the hands of heaven. The way Hashem's running the world, that's His business. Chutz mi yiras shamayim, the way I react to that, the way I choose to feel about that, that's my business. And what feeling am I speaking about specifically? Yira. What does it mean, yira? Yira means something very, very specific. It means like this. I make a choice. In fact, it's really the only choice that I make. When I see the world, and I look around myself, do I choose to live in awe of people, places, and things and feel that I must curry their favor, I must appease them, I must make sure that all these created beings are in the place where I want them to be, thinking of me how I want them to think of me? Or do I do what they call debt consolidation? You know, when you have a lot of creditors and they roll it into one easy payment. So instead of feeling that there are all these distinct forces in the universe that I have to appease and I have to please, instead, what do? I live in awe of Hashem alone. And that's the choice I make. Do I live trying to please people, places, and things and feel indebted to them and feel they can help me or harm me? Or do I make a decision that there's only one source of reality, it's Hashem alone, and the only thing I have to do is focus on my relationship with Him. The only awe that I need to feel in my heart is the awe of Hashem, who is the author of reality. And when I feel myself reacting to anything other than Hashem, I have to identify it as an unhealthy, as a neurotic, as a 2 plus 2 equals 4 and I can't stand it reaction. My power comes from the fact that I get to choose my relationship with reality by choosing my relationship with Hashem. That's what Emunah is. Emuna is the ability to relate to reality in the context of a relationship with Hashem. Somebody asked me, isn't Emuna essentially just fooling yourself, you know, keeping yourself placated instead of taking care of business? Right? Because sometimes we feel that if I'm not running around trying to control the world, trying to do Hashem's job, trying to take over the Hakol Bidei Shamayim and say, you know what, Hashem, I've been watching how you're running the universe, I have a few notes, forget it, it's too long, I don't want to explain the notes, just give me the wheel for a minute and I'll drive. Or at least as long as it takes me to get my life in order. Right? That neurotic impulse to play God. When I put my power and I put my energy in that area, so not only is it exhausting, because how can I ever effectively live up to a task that's not mine? It's not my job. Somebody once said, I do Hashem's work, not his job. What's Hashem's work? Acts of goodness and kindness. That's Hashem's work. Hashem's job? Running the universe. Thank God, I don't have to do that. It's not my job. How I react. The ability to show up for reality. That's my job. That's my job. And it's no one else's job. And if I don't show up for my life, who else is going to show up for me? You know the old story. That Reb Zusha was passing away and he was crying. His Talmidim were with him. And they said, Rebbe, why are you crying? He said, I fear judgment. So they said, Rebbe, you lived a life of perfect purity and piety. How in the world could you fear judgment? And if you fear judgment, it doesn't bode very well for the rest of us. Reb Zusha said, you don't understand. I'm not afraid I'm going to come l'mayla to the heavenly court, and they're going to look at me, they're going to look at my life, and they're going to say, Zusha, why weren't you like Avram Avinu? Zusha, why weren't you like Meshe Rabbeinu? I'm afraid they're going to look at me, they're going to look at my life, and they're going to say, Zusha, why weren't you like Zusha? So it's axiomatic that every single soul came to this world at this place, at this time, born from this mother and this father, to live this many years, months, days, hours, seconds, and in a particular place, under certain conditions, and it's a mission that no soul ever had before and will never have after, and it's your mission, it's your life. And if you don't show up for it, who else does? Now you're going to say, what do you mean if I don't show up for it? How could I not show up for my own life? Listen, let's be honest, okay? We all know what it means when somebody is physically present and they're not there, right? In this day and age, you'd be sitting in a room, and if you find any aspect of reality remotely displeasing, you check out of the room. I mean, you're still sitting in the seat. Think people still see you, right? You check out of the room and you go into your little reality in here, and I'm not here, right? So we all know what it means to not show up for life. Or not to show up for a moment of it. It means to not be emotionally present. So somebody was asking me, as I was saying before, isn't Emuna just a case of wishful thinking and placating yourself and not dealing with reality? You know, sometimes we feel guilty. If I'm actually calm and serene, I must be irresponsible, right? Responsible adults have to be stressed out and neurotic, right? So I explained my understanding. That unfortunately, there are two concepts that are often confused for each other in this day and age. And some of it has to do with the way people who represent faith misrepresent faith. I will admit that. There are some people who talk about faith, and it's not faith at all, what they're describing. It's a misappropriation of the term. I saw a great bumper sticker back home in the U.S., somebody had a bumper sticker that said, doesn't God want spiritual fruits, not religious nuts? I thought that was pretty good. So some people, in the name of faith, they say all sorts of wild things. Faith isn't wild. Faith isn't irresponsible. Faith isn't reckless. You know what faith is? There are two concepts that often get mistaken for one another, but if you understand the definition of both of them, you'll understand not only can they not be mistaken for each other, but they're as far apart as north and south. And those two concepts are fantasy and faith. What is fantasy and what is faith? Fantasy is an idea that I cling to in order to avoid facing reality. on the other hand, is an idea that I cling to in order to have the courage to face reality. Almost the same, but absolute opposites. Fantasy is an idea that I cling to in order to avoid facing reality. Fantasy is a drug. Fantasy is a distraction. Faith is an idea that I cling to in order to have the courage to face reality. In other words, if I'm really faithful, if I really put my trust in Hashem, if I really believe that every moment there's an author and he is orchestrating reality in a way that is best for me, then I have no fear to show up sober and lucid for every moment of that reality, and to experience whatever there is to be experienced, and not to shy away from it, and not to look away, and not to cover my eyes, and not to go into my distractions and my self-medicating, numbing behaviors that take me out of the here and now. So I'll tell you a little story. When I was, don't worry, it's just vodka. No, I'm joking. When I was a young rabbi, very young, like in my 20s, I was invited to speak to a group in America, in a small town, small city. The name of the group is called Gilda's Club. And it's named after a Jewish woman, an actress who passed away, Gilda Radner, Aleha Shalom, and her husband, Gene Wilder, also a Jew, made this thing in her honor, in her memory. She died of ovarian cancer at a young age. So they made Gilda's Club. It's a place where people with cancer can come together. It's not a medical facility. It provides support and chizuk for people who are dealing with this machla. At any rate, so I was a young rabbi, I was in my 20s, and I was invited to speak at Gilda's Club on the topic of faith in the face of adversity. And being a young rabbi, I was just happy anyone's asking me to speak, and I said, sure, I'll do it. As I'm pulling up to the place, it occurs to me, what in the world am I doing? I'm going to speak to a room full of cancer patients about faith in the face of adversity? What a chutzpah. No, I can't do this. I cannot do this. And I was literally ready to, I was driving in front of the place, I was literally ready to just drive away and just miss the appointment. But the lady who ran the place, she was one of these type A personalities, she had the, you know, the clipboard, and she's standing out front 5 minutes before I was to arrive, and she literally stood in front of my car. And she just walked over, oh, Rabbi, you're here, come. So I didn't want to run her over, so I got out of the car and I come with her and we're walking into the building. So walking into the building, now I'm stuck. So I'm thinking to myself, what am I going to do here? So I decided like this. Here's what I'm going to do. If at any moment anyone in the crowd will say to me, Rabbi, just stop. You're offending us. You don't know what you're talking about. What right do you have? I'm going to stop, and I'm going to apologize, and I'm going to say, you're right, I'm wrong, I'm sorry. And I'm just going to stop speaking. That was the deal that I made with myself as I'm walking into Gilda's Club. Incidentally, I just want you to know, that is not the deal I made with myself as I walked into this building this morning, so you can object all you want, I'm using my full 30 minutes. At any rate, and I'm walking in, I made this deal with myself, and I'm walking down the stairs. The event was in a basement, like a multi-purpose room. And we're walking down the stairs. As I'm walking down the stairs, it occurs to me why my plan is not a good one. And sometimes I say this story, and I mention this detail, and people laugh. I think it's funny that people laugh. I think it's funny that people think it's funny, because to me it's not funny at all. But I understand why to other people it is. I forget the fact. I need to be reminded of the fact that very often people look at me and they tend to associate me with Judaism. I don't think of myself that way. I'm just a guy. I'm just me, right? I don't think of the fact that people look at me and they say, hey, the Jew. So it occurred to me, as I'm walking down the steps to this speaking engagement, it's not okay for me just to say, you know what, you're right, I'm wrong, I'm sorry, I don't know what I'm talking about. If I'm just the guy, that's fine. I can say I'm an idiot. What do I care? But if I represent Torah, I can't allow that. Now, don't judge me here, because I'm telling you a story where I had literally 2 seconds to come up with a plan. You know, sometimes when you have 2 seconds to come up with a plan, and the adrenaline is pumping, and you're thinking really fast, and you think that you've come up with the most brilliant plan, then after you execute it, you realize it was just totally foolish? Okay, that's what happened here. So I have 2 seconds to think, and I decided like this. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to totally make something up. I'm going to make something up. And I said, don't judge the plan. It was a silly plan. But if I didn't come up with this silly plan, I wouldn't have this story to tell you, so it all worked out fine. I said to myself, I'm going to just make something up. And then if they say, Rabbi, you're offending us, then I'll stop and I'll say, ugh. Well, if they like it, they like it. Then that's fine. But if they don't like it, then I'm going to say, ugh. I really should have told you what Judaism says about this topic. Unfortunately, what I just told you, I just made up. That way, you know, it's my fault, and they don't cast aspersions on our beautiful tradition. That was the plan that I came up with. Like I said, please, don't judge me. I get up there, and I just started making stuff up. I said, I was thinking the other day. Well, that part wasn't made up, because I had been thinking the day prior to when this event took place, so that part was true. I said, I was thinking the other day about French New Wave cinema. French New Wave cinema, sure, why not? And about how these guys didn't just make films, they analyzed film, and they wanted to discuss what makes a great film. So they were sitting around one day, the French New Wave directors, and they're having their little coffees in their little coffee shop in Paris or wherever it is, and they're discussing who was the greatest director of all time. And they come to François Truffaut, and they say, François, who is the greatest director of all time? And François Truffaut says, no question, hands down, no problem. I'm going to give you guys a little English pride if you want. If you're proud of these types of things. François Truffaut says, greatest director in the history of cinema is Alfred Hitchcock. So they said, François, that's great, but now you have to defend it. You have to explain why it's Alfred Hitchcock. So Truffaut says, no problem. It's very simple why Hitchcock is the greatest. It's one reason. In all of his body of work, dozens of films, hours and hours and hours of footage that he put on the screen, and there's not one single superfluous shot. There's no filler. If Hitchcock put it on the screen for a second, it has to be there. It's significant. It's vital to the storytelling. Not one single superfluous shot. So I say to the group at Gilda's Club, I was thinking, could I say as much for Hashem and the movie of my life as Truffaut said for Hitchcock and the movies that he made? Could I say that Hashem has managed to show me a reality without a single superfluous shot? Now, what does it mean, without a single superfluous shot? It does not mean that there are not moments which I may not understand the meaning of. Some moments, some encounters may seem insignificant. But when I understand the story, I understand that every single detail of my life has been a message from the author of my life to me. And that everything is orchestrated, and no detail eludes his attention. And if something was noticed by me, even for a fleeting second, it was essential to the story of my life. And in fact, not only is every moment significant, even if it seems unimportant, I'll go even further than that. and say, moments which are painful, moments which I would not want to be part of my story, are also essential and integral to my story. In fact, it's interesting, when we think about a narrative and we think about a life, we use very different criteria. When we talk about a life, I was at a Shiva house once, and this woman said, "Ugh, Nabuchi had such a bad life." She was talking about the nifter, about the person who passed away. And I said, "Excuse me, why do you say that?" And she said, "He had so much loss, so much adversity." I said, "That is not a bad life. That's a challenging life. A bad life, that's a value statement. If a bad life would only be, he had resources, he had opportunities, but he was selfish, he sat on the couch, he loved no one, he gave nothing. That's a bad life. But to say he experienced loss, he experienced adversity, challenge, that's not a bad life. You call that a bad life?" It's interesting, if you would apply those same criteria to a narrative, and you would say, you know what's a good story? A good story is a story where nothing happens to the protagonist. No conflict, no character development, no nothing, no bad guys, certainly no antagonist. That would be bad. That's a good story. Can you imagine? You're reading a novel. Our hero woke up at 7 a.m. this morning, exactly at the time he had set his alarm. He went to go get breakfast. He reached for a carton of orange juice. No one just put it back with a drop left in it and pushed it in the back. No, it was full. Poured a full glass of orange juice. He went out to his car. It was the dead of winter. He turned the ignition and started on the first turn. He drove to work. No traffic. Made every green light. He arrived at the office 15 minutes early. Came to his desk. His boss hadn't put extra work there for him over the night. He sat down, he started to do the work. He didn't get any surprise calls, surprise emails. At 11:45, he broke 15 minutes early for lunch. He had a tuna fish sandwich on rye. It was excellent. Like, come on, when does the story begin? This isn't a story. You're boring me. But it's funny, when we talk about a life, oh, bore me, keep it boring. They say that pain is unavoidable, but suffering is self-inflicted. Pain is a stimulus response. There's nothing neurotic about pain. Pain is a reaction to stimulus. As situt veishaitmen, like we say in Yiddish. Suffering is totally cerebral. Suffering is when you take the stimulus of the pain and then analyze it in your own head, usually applying to it some type of victim script. So, this is too cerebral, so I'm going to act it out for you. You get up at 3 in the morning, and you're walking across the carpeted hallway, and your children were playing Legos on the carpet. And at 3 in the morning, with those half-asleep steps, those big heavy steps, you step right onto the Lego. You ever stepped onto a Lego in the carpet at 3 in the morning? And there's that half a second where you know that you are in for a world of pain. And there's nothing you can do to stop it. It's inevitable. And you just wait for it to happen. And it feels like an eternity. And it goes up to your brain, back to your toes. And you say, ow! That's pain. That's pain. Now, a second later, you bury your face in your hands and you say, why does stuff like this always happen to me? That's suffering. And if you're Jewish and you like a bargain, you can take 1 second of pain and milk it for a lifetime of suffering. You can always revisit your pain. In fact, you can make more suffering, the pain will subside. The suffering can become more intense as you meditate on it. So, in life there's pain. It's 9 o'clock, I'm finishing right now. In life there's pain. In life there are moments that are dark, that are scary, that are... moments of my story I never would have included in my story if I had any say. And yet, what does it mean to show up for my life? It means to realize that there's an author. And this author knows what he's doing. And he's telling me the perfect story to me, about me, and there's not one single superfluous shot. And as I'm saying this at Gilda's Club, all of a sudden this woman stands up and she says, "Rabbi!" And I look quickly, booming voice, and I look at her and she's very weak looking, physically emaciated. She's clearly been ravaged by this disease. It was incongruent, the booming voice and the very weak physical appearance. And she says, "I need to say something." I said, "Here it is. I made this agreement with myself. I'm ready." So I said, "Yes, please go ahead." So she says, "My friends all think I'm crazy when I tell them, no, I don't wish that I never got cancer." And they say, "Oh, did you give up? God forbid you gave up." And I tell them, "No, I didn't give up. I'm looking forward to living many happy, healthy years. I don't wish that I never got it." And they don't get that. They think either I'm splitting semantic hairs or they don't get it. And they don't understand, this is a very important concept to me. And I don't know how to explain that, no, I don't wish that I never got it. I'm looking forward in the future to beating it, but looking in the past, I don't wish that I never had it. And I couldn't explain it to them until now. Now I know why it's important to me not to wish to have never gotten it. One reason. Only one reason. Because I did. Because I did. And now at this point, to now wish to have not gotten it would mean to wish for some other reality other than my own. To wish for an easier story, no doubt. But not my story, apparently. Apparently not the story that God had in mind to tell me. And what's the proof? It's not the story that he told me. She says, "I don't want some other story. I don't want some other life. I want to hear my story. I want to have my life, the life that God is giving me." I was blown away. Mitalmida Yisra Mekulam. To me, this was an unforgettable lesson. Faith means that my life is an ongoing relationship with the author, and that every moment, even the painful moments, especially the painful moments, has meaning and is tailor-made for me. And there's not a single superfluous shot. So earlier I quoted a bumper sticker. Now I'm going to get really corny and I'm going to quote a refrigerator magnet. I saw it on a refrigerator magnet. But I don't care, because you have to take the truth from where it comes regardless of the source. And this is what I want to leave you with. Every moment is a gift. That's why it's called the present. There's an author to reality. An author who is creating the universe, something from nothing, every single second, just for you. All we need to do, show up for it, for every second of it. Hakol b'Shamayim, he's running the world. Chutz Miyira Shamayim, I've just got to keep the focus on my choices. That means my emotions and my attitudes and my behaviors. That's my duty. That's my job. He's running it. I show up for it. Keep my eyes open and experience every moment of it. Okay, thank you very much. All right.